catch up to him. Masculine pride had kept him trying to lead the way, although it was obvious that they ought to leave that to Alice. "Must be nice to live where the only thing to worry about is getting lost, and the horse takes care of that," he told Maureen. "She doesn't even know what I'm talking about. And last week, a girl her age, about 11, was raped in the Hollywood Hills, not more than half a mile from my house."
"One of Dad's secretaries was raped in the Capitol last year," Maureen said. "Isn't civilization wonderful?"
"I wish my boy could grow up out here," Harvey said. "Only, what would I do? Farm?" He laughed at himself. Then the way was too steep for talking. There was a dirt road at the bottom of the steep hillside. They were still a long way from the ranch, but it was easier now. Alice somehow got onto the horse. Harvey was watching the whole time, but he didn't see how she managed it. One second she was standing next to the animal, her head lower than its back, and the next moment she was astride. She clucked, and they galloped off. The illusion that she was somehow a part of the beast was even stronger. She moved in perfect rhythm with it, her long blonde hair flowing behind. "She's going to be one real beauty when she grows up," Harvey said. "Is it the air here? This whole valley's magic."
"I feel that way sometimes, too," Maureen told him.
The sun was low when they got back to the stone ranch house.
"Little late, but want to catch a swim?" Maureen asked.
"Sure, why not? Only I didn't bring a suit."
"Oh, there's something around."
Maureen vanished into the house and came back with trunks.
"You can change in there."
She pointed to a bathroom. Harvey got into the trunks. When he came out, she was already changed. Her one-piece suit was a shiny white material. She had a robe over one arm. She winked at him and dashed off, leaving Harvey to follow. The path led by a pomegranate grove and down to a sandy beach by a bubbling stream. Maureen grinned at him, then plunged quickly into the water. Harvey followed.
"Ye gods!" he shouted. "That's ice water!"
She splashed water onto his dry chest and hair.
"Come on, it won't hurt you."
He waded grimly out into the stream. The water was swift, out away from the banks, and the bottom was rocky. He had trouble keeping his feet, but he followed her upstream to a narrow gap between two boulders. The water plunged out swiftly there, threatening to dump both of them. It was just chest deep for Harvey.
"That cools you off fast," he said.
They paddled around in the pool, watching small trout dart near the surface. Harvey looked for larger fish, but they were keeping out of sight. The stream looked perfect for trout, deep pools below small rushing falls. The banks were overhung with trees, except for two places where they'd been cleared, obviously by someone who liked fly fishing and had opened the banks out for his back cast.
"I think I'm turning blue," Maureen shouted finally. "You finished?"
"Tell the truth, I was done 10 minutes ago."
They climbed out onto another of the enormous white boulders, the contours smoothed by floodwaters. The sun, low as it was, felt good on Harvey's chilled body, and the rock was still hot from old sunlight.
"I've been needing this," he said.
Maureen turned over on belly and elbows to look at him.
"Which, the freezing water, or the acrophobia, or the climbing your legs off?"
"All of the above, and not interviewing anyone today. I needed that, too. I'm glad your father didn't make it. Tomorrow, shazam, I'm Harvey Randall again."
She had changed back into the tan slacks. Harvey came out to find she'd also made drinks.
"Stay for dinner?" she asked.
"Well, sure, but can I take you out somewhere?"
She grinned.
"You haven't sampled the wild nightlife of Springfield and Porterville. You'll do better here. Besides, I like to cook. If you want, you can help clean up."
"Sure."
"Not that there's much cooking involved," Maureen said.
She took steaks out of the freezer.
"Microwave ovens and frozen food, the civilized way to gourmet meals.
That thing's got more controls than an Apollo."
"Not really. I've been in an Apollo." "Hey, you have too, haven't you?"
"I saw the mock-up," Harvey said. "Not the real thing. Lord, I'd like to do that. Watch the comet from orbit?
No atmosphere to block it out?
Maureen didn't answer. Randall sipped at his scotch. There was an edge on his hunger. He searched the freezer and found frozen Chinese vegetables to add to the meal. After dinner, they sipped coffee on the porch, in wide chairs, with wide flat arms to hold the mugs. It was chilly. They needed jackets. They talked slowly, dreamily, of the astronauts Maureen knew, of the mathematics in Lewis Carroll, of social politics in Washington. Presently, Maureen went into the house, turned off all the lights, and came back out, feeling her way. It was incredibly dark. Randall asked, "Why did you do that?" A disembodied voice answered, "You'll see in a few minutes." He heard her take her chair. There was no moon, and the stars lit only themselves. But gradually he saw what she meant. When the Pleiades came over the mountains, he didn't recognize them. The cluster was fiercely bright. The Milky Way blazed, yet he couldn't see his own coffee cup. "There are city people who never see this," Maureen said.
"Yeah, thanks."
She laughed.
"It could have been clouded over. My powers are limited."
"If we could..." "No, I'm wrong. I was thinking, if we could show them all what it looks like. All the voters. But you see star scenes on the newsstands all the time. Paintings of star clusters and black holes and multiple systems and anything you could find out there. You'd have to take the voters up here, a dozen at a time, and show them. Then they'd know. It's all out there. Real. All we have to do is reach out."
She reached out. Her night vision had improved that much, and took his hand.
He was a bit startled. She said, "Won't work. Otherwise the main support for NASA would come from the farming community."
"But if you'd never seen it like this..."
"Ah, you're probably right."
He was very aware that they were still holding hands, but it would stop there.
"Hey, do you like interstellar empires?"
"Harmless subject."
"I don't know. Tell me about interstellar empires."
Harv pointed and leaned close so she could sight down his arm.
Where the Milky Way thickened and brightened in Sagittarius, that was the galactic axis. "That's where the action is in most of the older empires. The stars are a lot closer together. You find Trantor in there, and the hub worlds. It's risky building in there, though. Sometimes you find that the core suns have all exploded. The radiation wave hasn't reached us yet."
"Isn't Earth ever in control?"
"Sure, but mostly you find Earth had one big atomic war."
"Oh, maybe I shouldn't ask, but just where are you getting your information?"
"I used to read the science fiction magazines. Then around age 20, I got too busy. Let's see, the Earth-centered empires tend to be small, but a small fraction of 100 billion suns. You get enormous empires without even covering one galactic arm."
He stopped. The sky was so incredibly vivid. He could almost see the mules' warships sweeping out from Sagittarius.
"Maureen, it looks so real."
She laughed. He could see her face now, pale, without detail.
He slid onto the broad arm of her chair and kissed her. She moved aside, and he slid in beside her. The chair held too, barely.
There is no harmless subject.
There was a point at which he might have disengaged. The thought that stopped him was, "Tomorrow, Shazam, I'm Harvey Randall again." Inside the house, it was utterly black. She led him by the hand, by touch and memory, to one of the bedrooms. They undressed each other. Their clothes, falling, might as well have fallen out of the universe. Her skin was warm, almost hot. For a moment he wished he could see her face, but only for a moment. There was gray light when he woke. His back was cold. They lay tangled together on a made bed. Maureen slept calmly, deeply, wearing a slight smile. He was freezing. She must be too. Should he wake her up? His slow brain found a better answer. He disentangled himself, gently. She didn't wake. He went to the other of the twin beds, pulled off the bedclothes, took them back, and spread them over her.
Then, with the full conviction that he was about to climb under the covers with her, he stood without moving for almost a minute. She wasn't his wife.
"Shazam," Harvey said softly.
He scooped up an armload of his clothes, careful to miss nothing. He padded out into the living room. He was starting to shiver. The first door he tried was another bedroom. He dumped the clothes on a chair and went to bed. Not dead, but transmuted. The comet is glorious in its agony. The streamer of its torn flesh reaches millions of miles, a wake of strange chemicals blowing back toward the cometary halo on a wind of reflected light. Perhaps a few molecules will plate themselves across the icy surfaces of other comets. Earth's telescopes find the comet blocked by the blazing sun itself. Its exact orbit is still uncertain. The glory of the tail is reflected sunlight, but more than sunlight glows in the coma. Some chemicals can lie intimately mixed at near absolute zero, but heat them and they burn. The coma seethes in change. The head grows smaller every day. Here, ammonia boils from the surface of an ice and dust mixture. The hydrogen has long since boiled out. The mass contracts and its density increases. Soon there will be little but rock dust cemented together by water ice. There, a stone monolith the size of a hill blocks the path of a gas pocket that grows hourly warmer until something gives. Gas blasts away into the coma. The stony mass pulls slowly away, tumbling. The orbit of Hamner Brown has been changed minutely. June 1. The Lord himself will descend from heaven with a cry of command, with the archangel's call, and with the sound of the trumpet of God. The dead in Christ will rise first. Then we who remain alive shall be caught up together with them in the clouds to meet the Lord in the air, and so we shall always be with the Lord. Paul of Tarsus, 1 Thessalonians. There at the top of the great disintegrating totem pole, there in that tiny space at the top, Rick Delante lay on his back with his smile blinking on and off. His carefully enunciated voice gave no hint of that. It sounded just like Johnny's, and Johnny Baker wore the slight frown of a man doing his delicate work.
"Switch to internal power."
"Internal power, check. In the green."
"T-minus 15 minutes and counting."
Whenever he glanced over at Rick, at that wavering smile, then Johnny's lips twitched at the corners. But Johnny Baker had been up before. He could afford to be supercilious. 15 minutes, and no glitches. It would take a man his whole life to write down all the glitches that could stop an Apollo launch. Delante kept smiling. They'd picked him. He'd gone through the training and the simulators, and then off to Florida. 2 days ago, he's been doing barrel rolls and loops and Immelmanns and dives above Florida and the Bahamas. That final loosening up flight 2 days before a launch was just too firm a tradition to get rid of. It worked the tension out of the chosen astronauts and laid it on the ground crew, who could go nuts wondering if their crew would smear themselves in a jet trainer after all that careful planning.
T-minus 1 minute and counting.
Those final hurried, crammed hours ended when Wally Hoskins led him up the elevator and arranged him, clumsy in his pressure suit, within the Apollo capsule. After that, he could lie on his back with his knees above his head, waiting for the glitch. But the glitch hadn't come yet, and it looked like they were going. It really?
5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Ignition. First motion.
Going.
We have liftoff.
The Saturn rose in thunder and hellfire. 100,000 official visitors and more, newsmen, science fiction writers with scrounged press passes, dependents of astronauts, VIPs, and friends.
There he goes, Maureen Jellison said.
Her father looked at her curiously.
We mostly call those ships she.
"Yes, I suppose so," Maureen said. "Why do I think I'll never see him again?"
Behind her, the vice president was muttering, just loud enough to hear.
"Go, go, you bird."
He looked up with a start, realized others were listening, and shrugged.
"Go, baby,"
he shouted. It did something to the watchers, the power of the thundering rocket, the knowledge that had gone into it. To the older watchers, it was something impossible, a comic book incident from their childhood. To the younger ones, it was inevitable and to be expected, and they couldn't understand why the older people were so excited. Spaceships were real, and of course they worked. Inside the Apollo, the astronauts smiled, the rictus smile of a cadaver, as several gravities pulled their facial muscles back onto their cheeks. Eventually, the first stage shut down and fell away, and the second stage did the same, and the third stage gave them a final push, and Rick Delante, in free fall, was still smiling.
"Apollo, this is Houston. You're looking good," the voice said.
"Roger, Houston." Delante turned to Baker.
"Now what, General?"
Baker grinned self-consciously. He'd been promoted just before the launch so that he'd be the same rank as the Soviet cosmonaut. "On one condition," the president had said when he handed Baker his stars.
"Yes, sir,"
Baker asked.
"You don't tease your Russian counterpart about his name. Resist the temptation."
"Yes, Mr. President."
But it was going to be hard. Peter Jakov didn't have a double meaning in Russian, but Comrade General Jakov spoke very good English, as Baker knew from their orientation meeting at Houston. He'd also met the other one, a dish, but only in Russia. She'd been officially too busy to come to the U.S.
"Now we find that bloody garbage can, Lieutenant Colonel Delante," Baker said. "Great up here, isn't it?"
"You know it."
Delante peered out, eyes wide in wonder. They had showed it all to him many times in simulators. There were movies, and the other astronauts talked incessantly of space. They put him in wetsuits underwater to simulate no gravity. But none of that mattered. This was real. There was the absolute black of space ahead, stars shining brightly, although the sun lit the Earth below. There were Atlantic islands, and coming up ahead was the coastline of Africa, looking just like a map with bits of cotton stuck on it for clouds. Later, to the north, was Spain and the Mediterranean Sea, and after a while the dark green slash across the wastelands of Egypt, the Nile with all its bends and crooks. And then they were in sunset, and the lights of the fabled cities of India lay below. They were above the darkness covering Sumatra when Delante got the blip on his radar screen.
"There it is," he said. "Hammer Lab."
"Rog," Baker acknowledged. He looked at the Doppler. They were slowly drawing up to the capsule. They'd catch up to it in dawn over the Pacific, just as Houston's computer had predicted. They waited. Finally, Baker said,
"Unlimber the cage. We've got to catch our house."
He thumbed the downlink set on.
"Goldstone, this is Apollo. Hammer Lab is in visual range. We are beginning final rendezvous maneuver."
"Apollo, this is Houston. What did you say was in visual range? Interrogative?"
"Hammer Lab,"
Baker said. He looked over at Delante and grinned. Officially, it was Space Lab 2, but who called it that? They approached rapidly, slowly, to the astronauts, who were themselves moving at 25,000 feet each second. Then it was time. Delante flew the Apollo. Jets edged their craft closer to their target. A big steel garbage can, 40 feet long and 10 in diameter, with viewports along the sides, one airlock, and docking hatches at each end.
"The economy prize space lab," Baker muttered. "It's tumbling. I make that one rotation in 4 minutes, 8 seconds.
First, to match completely with Hammer Lab, fire the Apollo's attitude jets in just the precise pattern so that it would tumble with the target. Then move closer to the thing, waiting for the chance, until the big docking probe on Apollo could enter the matching hole in the end of Hammer Lab. And they were in darkness again. Rick was amazed at how long it had taken him to fly what looked like far less than a mile. Of course, they'd also come 14,000 miles in the same 50 minutes. When dawn came, Rick was ready and made one pass and a second and cursed and eased forward and felt the slight contact of the two ships, and the instruments showed contact at center, and Rick drove forward hard.
"Virgin no more," he shouted.
"Houston, this is Apollo. We have docking. I say again, we have docking," Baker said.
"We know," a dry voice said from below. Colonel Delante's mic was live.
"Whoops," Rick said.
"Apollo, this is Houston. Your partners are approaching. Soyuz has you in visual. I say again, Soyuz has visual contact."
"Roger, Houston," Baker turned to Rick. "So now you stabilize this mother while I talk to friendly Asian brother and sister.
Soyuz, Soyuz, this is Apollo, over."
"Apollo, this is Soyuz,"
a male voice said. Jakov's English was grammatically perfect and almost without accent. He'd studied with American-speaking teachers, not Britishers.
"Apollo, we copy you 5x5. Is your docking maneuver completed? Interrogative. Over."
"We are docked with Hammer Lab. It is safe to approach. Over."
"Apollo, this is Soyuz. By Hammer Lab, do you mean Space Lab 2? Interrogative. Over,"
Baker said.
"Affirmative."
Delante was aware that he was using too much fuel. No one but a perfectionist would have noticed that. The maneuver was well within the error program devised by Houston, but Rick Delante cared. Eventually, they were stable. Apollo, its nose buried in the docking port in one end of the garbage can that was Hammer Lab, both now stable in space, not wobbling and not tumbling. The Apollo led at 25,000 feet per second, Baker and Delante, ass backward around the Earth each 90 minutes.
"Done," Rick said. "Now let's watch them try."
"Raj," Baker said. He activated a camera system. There was a cable connector in the docking mechanism, and the picture came through perfectly. A view of Soyuz, massive and closer than they'd expected, approaching Hammer Lab from the far side. The Soyuz grew, nose on. It wobbled slightly in its orbit, showing its massive bulk. Soyuz was considerably larger than the Apollo. The Soviets had always had their big military boosters to assist their space program, while NASA designed and built special equipment.
"That big mother better not have forgotten the lunch," Delante said, "or it will get hungry up here."
"Yep," Baker continued to watch. The Soyuz was vital to the Hammer Lab mission. It had brought up most of the consumables. Hammer Lab was packed with instruments and film and experiments, but there was food and water and air for only a few days. They needed Soyuz to stay for Hamner Brown's approach.
"Maybe it will anyway," Johnny Baker said. He looked grimly at the screen and at the maneuvering Soviet vehicle.
Watching was painful. Soyuz floundered like a dead whale in the tide. It nosed violently toward the camera and shied as violently back. It edged sideways, stopped, almost, tried again, and drifted away.
"And that's their best pilot," Baker muttered.
"I didn't look too good myself."
"Bullshit. You had a tumbling target. We're as stable as a streetcar."
Baker watched a few moments more and shook his head. "Not their fault, of course. Control systems. We've got the onboard computers. They don't. But it's a bloody damned shame." Rick Delante's mahogany face wrinkled.
"Don't know I can take much more of this, Johnny."
It was excruciating for both of them. It made the fingers flex, itching to take over. Backseat drivers are formed by such tensions.
"And he's got the lunch," Baker said. "When's he going to give up?"
They entered darkness. Communications with Soyuz were limited to official messages. When they came into the light again, the Soviet craft approached once more.
"It's going to get hungry up here," Delante said.
"Shut up."
"Yes, sir."
"Fuck you."
"Not possible in a full pressure suit."
They watched again. Eventually, Jakov called.
"We are wasting needed fuel. Request Plan B."
Soyuz, Roger, stand by to implement Plan B, Baker said, with visible relief. He winked at Delante. Now show the commies what a real American can do. Plan B was officially an emergency measure, but all the American mission planners had predicted privately that it would be needed. In the U.S., they'd trained as if Plan B would be the normal mode of operation. Across the Atlantic, it was hoped it wouldn't be needed, but they'd planned on it, too. Plan B was simple. The Soyuz stabilized itself, and the Apollo Hammerlab monstrosity maneuvered to it. Delante was flying a spacecraft and a big, clumsy, massive tin can. Now picture an aircraft carrier trying to maneuver under a descending airplane. But he also had the world's most sophisticated computer system, attitude controls painstakingly turned out by master machinists with thousands of hours' experience. Instruments developed in a dozen laboratories accustomed to making precision instruments. Houston, Plan B underway, Baker reported.
And now the whole damned world's watching me. Or listening, Rick Delante thought. And if I blow it...
That was unthinkable. Relax, Baker said. He didn't offer to do it himself, Delante thought.
Well, here goes, just like on the simulator.
It was. One straight thrust, check just before contact, and a tiny pulse of the jets to move the two crafts together. Again, the mechanical feel of contact, and simultaneously the flare of green lights on the board. Latch it, Rick said. Soyuz, we are docked. Latch the docking probe, Baker called. Apollo, affirmative. We are locked on. Last one inside's a rotten egg, Baker said. They shook hands formally all around as they floated inside the big tin can. A historic occasion, the commentators were saying below, but Baker couldn't think of any historic words to say. There was just too damned much to do. This wasn't a spectacular, a handshake in space like Apollo Soyuz. This was a working mission, with a hairy schedule that they probably couldn't keep up with, even with luck. And yet, Baker had the urge to laugh. He might have if it wouldn't have needed so many explanations. He would have laughed at how good they all looked. God bless us, there's none like us. Leonila Alexandrovna Malik was darkly beautiful. With her imperious self-confidence, she could have played a czarina, but her smooth, hard muscles would better have fitted her for the prima ballerina's role, a cold and lovely woman. Heartbreaker, Johnny Baker thought, but secretly vulnerable, like Moira Shearer in the Red Shoes. I wonder if she's as coldly polite with everyone as she is with Brigadier Djakov. Brigadier Pyotr Ivanovich Djakov, hero of the people. Which class, Baker wondered. The perfect man to illustrate an enlistment poster. Handsome, well-muscled, cold eyes. He looked a lot like Johnny Baker himself, and this wasn't really more surprising than Rick Delante's superficial resemblance to Muhammad Ali. Four of us, fully mature specimens in the prime of athletic good health, and photogenic as hell to boot. Pity that Randall fellow from NBS isn't here to take a group picture, but he'll get one, eventually. They floated at strange angles to each other, and shifted as in vagrant breezes, smiling at nothing. Even for Baker and Djakov it was exhilarating, and they'd been up before. For Rick and Leonila it was sheer heaven. They tended to drift toward the viewports and stare at the stars and Earth.
"Did you bring the lunch?" Delante asked.
Leonila smiled. The smile was cold.
Of course, I think you will enjoy it, but I will not harm Comrade Djakov's surprise.
First, we have to find a place to eat it, Baker said.
He looked around the crowded capsule. It was crammed with gear, electronics bolted to the bulkheads, styrofoam packing around amorphous lumps suspended on yellow nylon strapping, plastic boxes, racks of equipment, canisters of film, microscopes, a disassembled telescope, toolkits and soldering irons. There were multiple copies of diagrams that showed where everything was stowed, and Baker and Delante had drilled until they could literally lay their hands on any item in total darkness. but it made for crowding and gave no sense of order. "We can eat in the Soyuz," Leonila suggested. "It is packed, but..." She waved helplessly.
"It is not what we have been given to expect," Jakov said. "I have spoken to Baikunyar, and we are now on our own for a few hours, until we can deploy the solar wings. But I suggest we eat first."
"What's not what you've been given to expect?" Delanty asked.
"This,"
Jakov waved expressively. John Baker laughed.
"There wasn't time to do any real planning. Just pile the stuff aboard. Otherwise, everything here would have been designed especially for comet watching at half the weight."
"And 9 times the cost," Delanty said.
"And then there would have been no need of us," Leonila Malik said.
Jakov looked at her coldly. He started to say something, but decided not to. It was true enough, and they all knew it.
"Jesus, they sure packed it in," Delanty said. "Let's eat."
"You feel no effect from the freefall?" Leonila asked.
"Him? Old Iron Ear?" John Baker laughed. "Hell, he eats lunch on roller coasters. Now me, I feel it a bit, and I've been here before. It goes away."
"We should eat now. We are entering darkness, and we will want to deploy the solar wings in light," Jakov said.
"I, too, suggest the Soyuz, where there is more room. And we have a surprise. Caviar. It should be eaten in bowls, but doubtless we can make do from tubes."
"Caviar," Baker said.
"It is high in food value," Leonila said, "and soon the new canal will be finished, and there will be plenty of water in the Caspian and the Volga for our sturgeon. I hope you like caviar."
"Sure," Baker said.
"Shall we get to it?"
Jakov led the way into the Soyuz. No one noticed that Rick Delanty held back, as if reluctant to begin lunch after all. Delanty and Baker were outside. Thin lines connected them to Hammer Lab. Around them was the vacuum of space, brightly lit in sunshine, dark as the darkest cave in shadow. Skylab had wings covered with solar cells. They were supposed to deploy automatically, but they hadn't. Hammer Lab had a different design. The wings were folded against the body and were designed to be deployed by human muscle power. Baker and Delanty supplied that. The solar cell power was all needed. Without it, they couldn't operate the laboratory or even keep it cool enough to live in. Space is not cold. It has no temperature at all. There is no air to give it a temperature. Objects in sunlight absorb heat, which must be pumped out. Human beings generate even more heat. No man can live long in an insulated environment, whether a pressure suit or a space capsule. A man generates more heat inside each cubic inch of his body than the sun does in each cubic inch of its surface. Of course, there are a great many cubic inches of sun. So they needed the solar cells, and that took work. They moved large masses. In space there is no weight, but the mass remains, against friction. Their pressure suits resisted every motion, but eventually it was done. Nothing was broken, nothing was jammed. The system had been designed for simplicity, and to use the talents of intelligent men in orbit.
"At last," Johnny Baker said, "and we've got a few minutes' oxygen left. Rick, take a moment to enjoy the view."
"Good," Rick huffed into his mic.
Baker didn't like the way he said it. Delanty was breathing too hard and too irregularly, but he said nothing.
"I thought that last one would never come loose," Delanty puffed.
"But it did come loose, and if it hadn't, we'd have fixed it," Baker said. "Those goddamn bastards with their perfect black boxes. Well, this time they gave me the tools for the job. There's nothing a man can't do with the right tools."
"Sure, it's all a piece of cake now."
"Right, no worries. Barring a few international tensions, a possible Cuban hijacker, and several masses of dirty ice moving at 50 miles a second, our way."
"That's a relief."
Huff.
"Hey, John, I see South Africa. Only, you can't tell where the international boundaries leave off. No national borders. Johnny, I'm on the verge of a philosophical breakthrough."
You can't see the lines of latitude and longitude either, but that doesn't make them unimportant. So you can't see international borders from space, and everyone tries to make a big point of it. If we keep that up, you know what'll happen. Rick laughed.
Yeah, everybody's gonna start painting their borders in neon orange a mile wide. Then all the college kids will scream about damage to the environment.
And blame you for starting it. Let's go in.
June. Interludes.
But what about a direct head-on collision with a comet? How big and massive are the heads of comets? The head of a comet consists of two parts, the solid nucleus and the glowing coma. We only have to worry about the nucleus. Of course, comets vary a good deal in size. One estimate is that the nucleus of an average comet is 1.2 miles in diameter. But a really huge comet may have a nucleus thousands of miles in diameter. Any comet that hits the Earth directly is going to pack quite a wallop. Daniel Cohen, How the World Will End.
Woe to you, my people, for have you not raised the abomination of desolation across the earth? Have you not seen the wickedness of the cities and smelt the very stench of the air itself? Have you not defiled the earth, which is the very temple of the Lord? Hear the words of the prophet Malachi. For behold, the day cometh that shall burn as an oven, and all the proud, yea, and all that do wickedly, shall be stubble. And the day that cometh shall burn them up, saith the Lord of hosts, that it shall leave them neither root nor branch. But unto you that fear my name shall the Son of Righteousness arise, with healing in his wings. My people, the hammer of God comes to smite the wicked and the proud. But the humble shall be exalted. Repent while there is yet time. For no man can escape the mighty hammer that even now blots out the stars. Repent before it is too late. There is yet time.
Thank you, Reverend Armitage. You have heard the Reverend Henry Armitage and The Coming Hour. Mark Chescu had the sake heating in a reagent bottle with a ground glass stopper. He poured refills into tiny cups, then poured more sake into the bottle and set it back in water simmering on the stove.
I had two plants sitting on my desk, he said. One was a rubber marijuana plant with Cannabis sativa stamped under the leaves. The other was an Aralia elegantissima. If you don't know, it looks a lot like marijuana.
He handed a cup to Joanna, another to Lilith.
One day my boss came in with a bigwig from the central office. They didn't say anything that day, but the next day my boss was saying, get rid of it.
He handed Frank Stoner the third cup and settled in the armchair with his own.
I said, what? He said, I'm not completely ignorant, you know. I know what that is. Carol Miller went into hysterics. She called the other guys in and we made him repeat it. They all knew what it was.
Frank Stoner sprawled in sinful comfort on the couch, with Joanna McPherson under one arm and the other around Lilith Hathaway's waist. Lilith was his own height, 5'9", but tiny Joanna's shoulders just fit beneath Frank's thick arm. He asked,
"How long ago was that?"
"Couple of years. They had to lay me off 2 months later."
Frank grinned. "By one of those interesting statistical flukes."
"Huh? No, it had nothing to do with the rubber marijuana. They just had to lay off some people. Since then, well, the steadiest work has been with Harv Randall."
Mark leaned forward, eyes sparkling.
"Those men in the street gigs are fun. We met this army colonel who was afraid to open his mouth, afraid something would get out. There was a guy at a wrestling match who couldn't wait for Hammerfall. That's when the real He-Men will rule the world, right?"
He smiled at Lilith, who was a pale blonde with a lovely heart-shaped face and big boobs. He'd met Lilith at the interchange, the topless bar where she danced. Frank Stoner was sipping just enough sake to be polite. Mark hadn't noticed. He emptied his cup in one swallow. You had to drink it fast or it would get cold, and said,
"We even interviewed some bikers. The unholy rollers were in that night. I don't think they took it seriously, though.
Joanna laughed. End of the world. No cars on the road. No fuzz. Your biker friends would think that was Fat City.
But they couldn't say that.
It may be true, said Frank Stoner. He and Mark had met on the dirt tracks, fighting it out for prize money across the country.
We can go places cars can't. We don't use as much gas. We stick together. We don't mind a fight. If we had some gas cached somewhere. Hey, what are the chances?
Mark waved a hand and almost hit his cup.
Almost zilch, unless you believe the astrology columns. Sharp says we might go through the tail, though. Man, won't that be a kick?
Joanna explained. Sharps is one of the astronomers they interviewed. She got up to refill sake cups.
Yeah, and he was stranger than any of them. You'll see it on TV. Hey, did you know that Hot Fudge Sunday falls on a Tuesday this month?
He gave it a good dramatic pause, during which Joanna got the giggles, before he went on. An hour later, and Lilith had to go to work. The sake was dwindling fast. Mark was feeling good. Joanna was feather light in his lap, while he and Frank talked around her. Mark had been living with Joanna for almost 2 years now. Sometimes it struck him as strange that he had gotten himself involved with a total monogamist. It had changed his lifestyle, sure, and he liked it. Granted, he didn't dare sleep with anyone else, but he didn't get into as many fights either. And he still met interesting people. He'd been afraid that would end.
You'd have a hell of a time getting back in shape, said Frank.
Huh?
Mark tried to remember what they'd been talking about. Oh, yeah, the duels they'd fought on the racing circuit years ago. For Mark, the dirt tracks were a spectator sport these days. He still had the muscles, but he had grown a great soft pillow of a beer belly. He glanced down and said,
Right, well, Joanna's making me have the baby.
Fair's fair, Joanna said. You lost the toss.
I'm getting too old for fooling around. I should sign up permanently with Randall.
He picked up Joanna and set her on her feet. Yes, the muscles were still there. And went to the kitchen for the last of the sake. He called,
What do we do if the hammer hits?
Don't be there, Stone answered.
A few seconds later,
Don't be at the beach either. Don't be near a coastline. 3 out of 4, it'd be an ocean strike. Bring me a beer.
Yeah.
You got a map of the fault lines in California, don't you?
Mark was sure he did. He began hunting for it.
Frank said, I think I'd want the same bike I took to Mexico. The big single, the Honda 4-stroke. Not so much problem getting spare parts.
Frank let his mind track possibilities, taking its time. He and Joanna and Mark, they'd known each other a long time. They didn't have to talk, just to fill in silences, though Mark did have a touch of that.
You'd have to think about riots and rip-offs, the rain and the tidal waves and earthquakes. They'd wipe out all the services, cops included. I guess I'd want gas and bike parts hidden outside the city, someplace where nobody could steal them.
Guns?
I brought a souvenir back from Nam, registered lost.
So did I.
Mark gave up on the map.
We'd want a siphon. For a while, you'd find abandoned cars.
I always carry a siphon.
Hey, why don't we get together about the time the head's supposed to pass?
Frank didn't answer immediately. Joanna said,
Even if nothing happens, it'd be a great comet-watching party. Maybe we could get Lilith in.
Frank Stoner thought it over for a few seconds longer than was tactful. He did not make promises lightly, and the comet was becoming real to him. Mark was a good man in a fight, but he couldn't always do what he said he could do, and he tended to drop things, and there was that brand new beer belly. To Frank, that belly was a piece of personal sloppiness. Still,
Yeah, okay. Not here, though. Say we take some sleeping bags up onto Mulholland the night before.
Mark raised his sake cup in salute.
Good. It'd take a bitch of a tsunami to reach that high. And we could go off the road if we had to.
He would have been displeased if he could have followed Frank's reasoning. Frank was concerned for Joanna. He didn't think Mark could protect her, and Joanna, with her kung fu training and women's lib self-confidence, probably thought she could protect herself. It took Eileen almost half a minute to realize that Mr. Corrigan was sitting on the edge of her desk, studying her. Bolt upright at her desk, she sat with her fingers motionless on the keyboard. Her eyes seemed to study a blank wall, and then, somehow, they found Corrigan in the foreground. She said,
"Yeah."
"Hi, it's me," said Corrigan. "Care to talk about it?"
"I don't know, boss."
"About a month ago, I would have sworn you were in love. You'd come in with that sappy look, and sometimes you'd be dead tired and grinning all over. I thought your efficiency would go down, but it didn't."
"It was love," she said, and smiled. "His name's Tim Hamner. He's indecently rich. He wants me to marry him. He said so last night."
Said Corrigan, not liking that. "The crucial question, of course, is whether the business will collapse without you."
"Naturally, that was the first thing I thought of," said Eileen, but with a pensive look that Corrigan didn't quite know how to take.
"Occupational hazard," he said briskly. "Do you love him?"
"Oh, yes, but..." "Nuts. I've already made up my mind," she said. "But I don't have to like it."
And she attacked her typewriter with a ferocity that drove Corrigan back to his own desk. She called Tim 3 times before she found him home. Her first words were,
"Tim, I'm sorry, but the answer's no."
Long pause, then,
"Okay, can you tell me why?" "I'll try. It'd make what I've been doing look silly."
"I don't see that."
"Just before we met, I made assistant general manager at Corrigan Plumbing Supplies."
"You told me. Listen, if you're afraid of losing your independence, I'll settle. Say $100,000 on your cringing head, and you'll be as independent as anyone."
"I don't know how I knew you'd say that, but that isn't it. It's me. I'd change more than I'd like. I made myself what I am, and I want to stay proud of the result."
"You want to keep your job?" Tim had trouble getting the word out. He must have thought the idea was silly, but...
"Okay."
Eileen pictured herself arriving at Corrigan's every morning in a chauffeured limousine, and she laughed. After that, things went all to hell. Colleen was reading a paperback novel. Her hair was in curlers. She'd switched on the stereo, and sometimes her fingers tapped in rhythm on the table beside her easy chair. Fred wondered wistfully what she was hearing. He knew what she was reading. He couldn't see the title, but the cover bore a woman in long, flowing garments in the foreground and a castle in the background, with one lighted window. Gothics were all alike, outside and in. And he didn't mind the curlers. She looked cute in them. Half the joy was in the anticipation. Soon, soon they would meet. Sometimes the guilt was overwhelming. Then the mad temptation would come on Fred Lauren, to destroy his telescope, to destroy himself, before he could hurt Colleen. But that really was insane. A month and a week from now, he would be dead anyway, and so would she. Any hurt he did her would be a passing thing, and done for love. For love. Fred yearned for the girl in his telescope. His hands were tender on the little wheels that controlled the image, and the fingers trembled. It was too soon, much too soon.
June 2.
"General, you don't have a war plan. All you have is a kind of horrible spasm."
Secretary of Defense Robert S. McNamara, 1961.
"The policy of the United States remains unchanged. Upon confirmation of actual nuclear attack on this nation, our strategic forces will inflict unacceptable damage on the enemy."
Pentagon spokesman, 1975.
Sergeant Mason Jefferson Lawton was SAC and proud of it. He was proud of the sharply creased coveralls and the blue scarf at his throat and the white gloves. He was proud of the .38 on his hip. It was late afternoon in Omaha. The day had been hot. Mason glanced at his watch again, and just as he did,
The KC-135 swept out of the sky and down the runway. It taxied over to the unloading area where Mason waited. The first man out was a colonel permanently stationed at Offutt. Mason recognized him. The next man fit the photograph security had furnished. They came over to the jeep.
ID, please, Mason asked.
The colonel took out his without a word. Senator Jellison frowned.
I just came in on the general's plane with your own colonel.
Yes, sir, Mason said, but I need to see your ID.
Jellison nodded, amused.
He took a leather folder from an inside pocket, then grinned as the sergeant came to an even more rigid position of attention. The card was Jellison's Air Force Reserve Officer ID and showed him to be a lieutenant general. And that, Jellison thought, ought to shake the kid up. If it did, Mason showed no other signs. He waited while another officer brought Jellison's bag and put it in the jeep. They drove down the runway, past the specially equipped looking-glass ship. There were three of those ships, and one was in the air at all times. They carried a Strategic Air Command general officer and staff. Back at the end of World War II, SAC headquarters was put in Omaha, at the center of the U.S. The command center itself was built four stories below ground and reinforced with concrete and steel. The hull was supposed to withstand anything, but that was before ICBMs and H-bombs. Now there were no illusions. If the big one came off, the hole was doomed. That wouldn't keep SAC from controlling its forces, because Looking Glass couldn't be brought down. No one except its pilots ever knew where it was. Mason ushered the senator into the big brick building and up the stairs to General Bambridge's office. The office had an old-fashioned air about it. The wooden furniture, most with leather upholstery, was ancient. So was the huge desk. The walls were lined with shelves, each holding USAF models, World War II fighters, a huge B-36 with its improbable pusher props and jet pods, a B-52, missiles of every description. These were the only modern features, except the telephones. There were three on the desk, black, red, and gold. A portable unit containing a red and a gold phone stood on a table near the desk. Those phones went with General Bambridge, in his car, to his home, in his bedroom, in the latrines. He was never more than four rings from the gold phone, and never would be during his tour of duty as Commander-in-Chief, Strategic Air Command. The gold phone reached the President. The red one went downhill, from Bambridge to SAC, and it could launch more firepower than all the armies in history had ever employed. General Thomas Bambridge waved Senator Jellison to a seat and joined him in the conversation group near the big window overlooking the runway. Bambridge didn't sit behind his desk to talk to people unless there was something wrong. It was said that a major once fainted dead away after 5 minutes standing in front of Bambridge's desk.
"What the hell brings you out here like this?" Bambridge asked.
"What couldn't we settle on the phones?"
"How secure are your phones?" Jellison asked. Bambridge shrugged.
"As good as we can make them."
"Maybe yours are all right," Jellison said. "You've got your own people to check them. I'm damn sure mine aren't safe. Officially, it's what I told you. I need some help understanding budget requests."
"Sure. You want a drink?"
"Whiskey, if you've got it here."
"Sure."
Bambridge took a bottle and glasses from the cabinet behind his desk.
"Cigar? Here, you'll like 'em."
"Havana?" Jellison said. Bambridge shrugged.
"The boys get 'em in Canada. Never have got used to U.S. cigars. Cubans may be bastards, but they sure can roll cigars."
He brought the whiskey to the coffee table and poured.
"Okay, just what is this all about?"
"The hammer," Arthur Jellison said. General Bambridge's face went blank.
"What about it?"
"It's coming pretty close."
Bambridge nodded.
"We've got some fair mathematicians and computers ourselves, you know.
So what are you doing about it?"
"Nothing, by order of the President." He pointed to the gold phone.
"Nothing is going to happen, and we mustn't alarm the Russians," Bambridge grimaced.
"Mustn't alarm the bastards. They're killing our friends in Africa, but we shouldn't upset them, because it might mess up our friendship."
"It's a hard world," Jellison said.
"Sure it is.
Now what is it you want?"
Tom, that thing's coming close. Really close. I don't think the President understands what that means.
Bambridge took the cigar out of his mouth and inspected the chewed end.
The President doesn't take much interest in us, he said. That's good, because he leaves SAC pretty much to run itself. But good or bad, he's President, which makes him my Commander-in-Chief, and I've got funny notions, like I ought to obey orders.
Your oath to the Constitution, Jellison said. And weren't you a pointer? Duty, honor, country, in that order?
So?
Tom, that comet's coming really close.
Really.
They tell me it'll knock out all your early warning radars.
They tell me that, too, Bambridge said.
Art, I don't want to be a smartass, but aren't you trying to teach your grandmother to suck eggs?
He went to the desk and brought back a red-covered report.
We'll see what looks like an attack that isn't really there, and we won't be able to see a real one, if there is one. Sure, the day they think they can win clean, they'll hit us, but air intelligence tells me things are pretty quiet over there right now.
Bambridge thumbed through the document again, and his voice fell.
Of course, if we can't see them coming, they couldn't see us.
Get that look off your face.
Well, I can't be court-martialed just for thinking.
This is serious, Tom. I don't think the Russians will start anything, so long as it's only a near miss. But,
Bambridge cocked his head to one side.
Jesus, my people didn't tell me it would hit us.
Nor did mine, Jellison said. But the odds are now hundreds to one against. Used to be billions, then thousands. Now it's only hundreds. That's a little scary.
It is that. So what am I supposed to do? The President ordered me not to go on alert.
He can't give you that order. Your charter says you have authority to take any measure needed to protect your forces. Anything short of launching.
Christ, Bambridge looked out the window. The looking glass KC-135 was taking off, which meant that the airborne ship would be coming in after its replacement was safely airborne and lost.
You're asking me to defy a presidential direct order.
I'm telling you that if you do, you've got friends in Congress. You might lose your job, but that'll be the worst.
Jellison's voice was very low and urgent.
Tom, do you think I like this? I doubt that goddamn comet will hit Earth, but if it does, and we're not ready, God knows what will happen.
That's for sure. Bambridge tried to imagine it.
An asteroid strike in some remote part of the Soviet Union.
Would they believe it wasn't a U.S. sneak attack?
Or why remote?
Moscow.
But if we've gone to alert status, they'll know it, and it'll give them that much more reason to think we did it, Bambridge said.
Sure. And if we haven't gone to alert, and they see this as a golden opportunity.
If the hammer hits, Washington may be gone, Tom.
Washington, New York, most of the eastern seacoast.
Shit. All we'd need would be a war on top of that, Bambridge said.
If the hammer really does hit, the world is going to be in a big enough mess without starting the big one to go with it.
But if it hits us and not them, they'll want to finish the job.
It's what I'd do if I was them.
But you wouldn't.
Not from this office, Bambridge said. Not even if I got orders that I'll never, thank God, get.
The general stared at the missile models on the far wall.
Look, what I can do is see that my best people are on duty. Put my top men in the holes, and I'll be up in looking glass myself.
But how do I tell a meteor hit from a missile attack?
I think you'll know, Jellison said.
Outside was night and glory. In the Apollo capsule, Rick Delanty was moored to his couch. His eyes were tightly closed, and he lay rigid, fists clenched.
All right, damn it. I've been sick ever since we came up. But don't tell Houston. There's nothing they could do anyway.
You damn fool, you'll starve, Baker told him. Hell, it's no disgrace. Everybody gets space sickness.
Not for a whole week.
You know better. McCalliard was sick the whole mission. Not as bad as you, but he had help. And I'm getting Dr. Malik.
No.
Yes. We haven't got time for macho pride.
That's not it, and you know it.
Delanty's voice was pinched.
She'll report it, and...
And nothing, Baker said. We're not going to scrub this mission just because you keep puking up your guts.
You're sure of that?
Yeah, they can't abort unless I say so, and I won't. Unless
nothing, Delante said. That's the whole point. Good God, Johnny, if this flops because of me, hell, I wish they'd picked somebody else. Then it wouldn't matter so much. But I've got to keep going.
Why? Baker demanded. Because I'm a gentleman of color.
Black. Try to remember. He tried to grin. All right, get the lady doc. Something's got to help. Mother Sills, maybe?
Best thing is to keep your eyes closed.
Which I'm doing, and a fat lot of help I am, Delante said. His voice was bitter. Me, old Iron Ear, space sick. It's insane. He realized Baker had left and nervously began buttoning up his fly.
The official name was Sustained Duty Clothing. Everyone else would have called them long johns or a union suit. What the well-dressed spaceman will wear. It's a very practical costume, but Rick Delante couldn't quite hide his nervousness. He wasn't used to having women see him in his underwear, especially not white women.
Man, will the old boys in the back towns in Texas go nuts over this, he muttered.
What is this you have not reported?
Her voice was sharp, totally professional, and blew away any residual thoughts Rick Delante might have had. She came into the capsule and unclipped a lead from Rick's union suit. She plugged it into a thermometer readout. The other end of the lead went inside the long johns and up inside Rick Delante. All astronauts became gun-shy about their anuses. Not that it did them any good. Leonila said, "Have you eaten anything at all?" She read the thermometer and made a note.
"Nothing that stays down."
"So you are dehydrated. We will try these first. Chew this capsule. No, do not swallow it whole. Chew it."
Rick chewed. "Jesus Christ, what is this stuff? That's the nastiest—"
"Swallow, please. In 2 minutes we will try a nutrient drink. You need hydration and nourishment. Do you often fail to report illnesses?"
"No, I thought I could make it."
"In every space mission, approximately one-third of the personnel involved have experienced from mild to extreme forms of space sickness. The probability that one of us would have the difficulty was very high. Now drink this, slowly." He drank. It was thick and tasted of oranges.
"Not bad."
"It is based on American Tang," Leonila said. "I have added fruit sugars and a vitamin solution. How do you feel?" "No, do not look at me. It is important that this stay down. Keep your eyes closed."
"It's not too bad this way."
"Good.
But I'm no damned use with my eyes closed, and I've got to—"
"You've got to rehydrate and stay alive so the rest of us can stay here," Leonila said. Delante felt something cold on his forearm.
"What?"
"A sleeping injection. Relax. There. You will sleep for several hours. During that time, I will give you an intravenous. Then, when you are awake, we can try other drugs. Good night."
She went back into the main Hammer Lab compartment. There was room in the center of it now. The equipment had been stowed in proper places, and much of the styrofoam packing had been ejected out into space.
"Well?"
John Baker demanded. Peter Jakov asked the same thing in Russian.
"Bad," she said. "I think he has not kept water in his system for at least 24 hours, possibly longer. His temperature is 38.8, badly dehydrated."
"So what do we do?"
Baker asked.
"I think the drugs I have given him will keep the drink down. I gave him nearly a liter, and he showed no signs of distress. Why did he not tell us before?"
"Hell, he's the first black man in space. He doesn't want to be the last one," Baker said.
"Does he think he is the only one under pressure to succeed?"
Leonila demanded.
"He is the first black man in space, but the physiological differences between races are small compared to those between sexes. I am the second woman in space, and the first failed."
"It is time for more observations," Peter Jakov said. "Leonila, assist me. Or must you attend to your patient?"
With the gear properly stowed, there was still very little room to spare in Hammer Lab. They had found ways to achieve some privacy. Delanty in the Apollo, Leonila Malik in the Soyuz. Baker and Jakov traded off watchkeeping and slept in Hammer Lab, when they slept at all. With three to cover the work of four, there wasn't a lot of time for sleep. And Hamner Brown was approaching. Tail first it came, directly toward them, the tenuous gas that streamed from it already engulfing Earth and Moon and Hammer Lab. They took hourly observations, visual, and daily went outside to gather samples of nothing, the thin vacuum of space bottled to take back to Earth, where sensitive instruments could find a few molecules of a comet's tail. At first there was little to see. Only in the direction of the comet was it obvious that the tail was streaming across space to cover hundreds of millions of miles. But later, as it came closer, they could see it in any direction they looked. When they weren't watching the comet, they could take observations of the sun. There were another dozen experiments in crystallography, in thin film research, to occupy any spare time left from that. It made for a busy day. They hadn't much privacy, but they had some. By mutual agreement and ship design, the personal facilities were in the spacecraft, not the lab capsule. For Baker and Delanty, the system was simple enough. A tube to fit over their male members with a tank to pee in. It flushed. This time, when Baker used the system, he felt Delanty's eyes on him. "You're supposed to be asleep, not watching me piss."
"You I'm not interested in. Johnny, how does Leonila manage it, in space?"
"Yeah, I managed to forget, I don't know. I'll ask her, huh?"
"Sure, do that. It's a cinch I'm not gonna."
"Me either." Johnny opened a valve. Urine jetted from the Apollo into space. Frozen droplets formed a cloud around the craft, like a new constellation of stars, and gradually dissipated. "Why the hell did you get me worrying about that again?"
"I should be the only one with trouble."
"How are you getting along?"
"Pretty good."
2 days later, Delanty was much better, but Baker didn't have an answer. He had just returned from taking a vacuum sample and was alone with Jakov when Baker said,
"I can't stand it."
"I beg your pardon," the Russian said. "Something bothering me. How does Leonila take a leak in free fall?"
"This concerns you."
"Sure. It's not even idle curiosity. One reason we never sent women into space, the design boys couldn't come up with proper sanitary facilities. Someone suggested a catheter, but that hurts."
Jakov said nothing.
"So how does she do it?" Johnny demanded.
"That is a state secret, I'm sorry," Peter Jakov said. Could he be joking? It didn't show. "It is time for a new series of solar observations. Will you help me with the telescope, please?"
"Sure."
"I'll ask Leonila," Johnny thought, "before we get down, anyway." He glanced sideways at the Russian. Maybe Jakov didn't know either.
"How you doing?"
Baker asked.
"Fine," Delanty said. "Does Houston know?"
"Not from me," Baker said. "Maybe from Bakunyar. I don't guess Jakov keeps much from his people. But why should they tell Houston?"
"I hate it," Rick said.
"Sure you do. So what? You've proved whatever you needed to. You're here, and we got the wings opened out. Christ, man, if you can do that kind of work while you're sick, they ought to call you Iron Man. You'll be working tomorrow."
"Yeah. You solved that problem that was bothering you?"
Baker shrugged. "No, I asked Peter. State secret," he said. "State secret, my ass."
"Well, maybe we can find out. We've sure got enough cameras."
"Sure, that'll look good in the report. Two U.S. Air Force officers sneaking into the ladies' powder room with cameras." "Well, I've got the watch. I'll go wake up Comrade Brigadier. See you."
Johnny Baker floated out of the Apollo capsule and across Hammer Lab. It was quiet out there. Leonila was asleep in Soyuz, Delanty strapped down in Apollo, and Jakov supposedly catching a nap before going on watch. Baker swam toward the Russian's bunk. In the maze of telescopes and cameras and growing crystals and X-ray detectors, Jakov floated, lightly strapped to a nylon web.
He was grinning at the bulkhead. When Johnny reached him, the grin blinked out. Like he just gave somebody a hot foot, Johnny Baker thought, and was caught in the act. State secret, my ass.
This audiobook has been broken into multiple parts to make the download faster. You have reached the end of a part, but not the end of the complete audiobook, so please check your library for the next part of this audiobook.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.